Listeners, you know what makes me descend into pure madness? Running out of coffee. Luckily, Sparkplug Coffee offers regular deliveries anywhere in Canada so that you can set it and forget it and never run out of coffee again.
The beans.
And Sparkplug roasts your beans right before they deliver it so that you're getting only the freshest, highest quality coffee. Sparkplug offers flavors and grinds to suit any taste. It even offers a rotating special blend for those of us who like to mix it up. Right now, I'm enjoying this month's special flavor, El Liberator, a special blend that brings together the delicious organic fair trade beans from Peru and Bolivia. It's smooth, rich, and full-bodied with all the characteristics we love from South American coffee. So get started today and make your favorite cup of coffee in your own kitchen. Go to sparkplugcoffee.com.
And I have to say it, I love the smell of coffee in the morning.
Ah, there you got it.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
They're going to make me a major after this podcast, and I'm not even in their fucking army anymore. Hey there, and thanks for checking out the Top 100 Project as we hit number 100. We've got 23 more to go, so we're still far from finished as we continue to analyze the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of America's greatest movies. Spoilage! We are about to wreck this classic picture. I am Ryan Ellis, sitting with the PBR sailor of my dreams, my wife of 2+ years, Bev.
That's me.
And I won't be burning her pitcher with a cigarette anytime soon. The coming attractions trivia for this week's film, Apocalypse Now. How many AFI movies did Marlon Brando, Robert Duvall, Dennis Hopper, and Harrison Ford appear in total?
Okay, I must be forgetting something, but by my count, altogether was 14.
You're way off.
What?
19.
What am I missing?
So Brando's in Streetcar Named Desire, On the Waterfront, way back in the 50s. Obviously The Godfather earlier this decade, now Apocalypse Now. Duvall, 6 AFI movies. Other than Ward Bond, who's a fairly small player in 7 AFI movies, he's in the most. All supporting performances. This is his final one. He was in The Two Godfathers, MASH before that, To Kill a Mockingbird before that, and Network. Dennis Hopper, 4 AFI movies. Rebel Without a Cause, then Giant, then Easy Rider, and now Apocalypse Now. Bev is waving her fist.
I forgot about Rebel Without a Cause.
And Harrison Ford may be a small player in this movie, but this is 1 of 5 for him. We've covered 2 already. American Graffiti, Star Wars, and he's still got Raiders and Blade Runner.
Okay, you counted movies twice. That's the difference. If you only count each movie once, then it's still 14.
How is it 14?
Okay, I accidentally counted Godfather 2 for Marlon Brando. I forgot about Rebel Without a Cause, so they would cancel each other out. So if I were to look at my list, I would still have 19 movies listed.
Okay, well, 19 is the
answer. Okay.
The point of this was, and I condensed this question, when I first came up with it months ago, it was going to be about 3 or 4 other people. It was going to include Francis Ford Coppola, the director, how many movies he's got, Scott Glenn's in this movie, Sam Bottoms, G.D. Spradlin, a lot of obscure ones. We will talk about their credits later on, but that's another 10 or more, because Francis Ford Coppola is finally done with his 5th AFI film in his 3rd directorial effort. And here we go, the Top 100 Project's 100th movie, Apocalypse Now, was 28th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 between Bonnie and Clyde and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. What a weird threesome that is. Then took a tiny dip to 30th. What the fuck? Why is it dipping at all? In 2007, between 40s noir classics, This Is Good, Double Indemnity, and Maltese Falcon. If you're going to dip, that's a pretty good twosome to be between.
Good company.
Zoetrope Studios, Coppola's company, and United Artists, we've mentioned them a lot the last few months, gave Apocalypse Now a glitzy release on August 15th, 1979. The notoriously over-budget film also raked in a bunch of money. Now, you probably know Apocalypse Now, but in case you don't, here's Bev to describe it for you with the skinny.
Martin Sheen plays Willard, a brooding army captain who's assigned a secret mission in Vietnam to kill the rogue Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando, who has gone from the perfect officer fast-tracking his way up the ranks to a rogue AWOL madman with his own private army in Cambodia. Robert Duvall is Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore, a ballsy commander of a helicopter unit who likes surfing and reminiscing about past olfactory thrills.
Or in a nutshell, the death of one outweighed the lives of the many. Similar theme in Saving Private Ryan, a fellow AFI war film, and the last war film on the list. Okay, a few numbers, not a lot. The Rotten Tomatoes critics gave it tremendous scores. 99% of critics liked it, 74 fresh, only one rotten. 94% of audiences, and Apocalypse Now Redux, which they redid in 2001, still, despite its flaws, got 93% of critics and 90% of audiences. Apocalypse Now was 6th on the 2012 Sight and Sound Directors Poll. I think that was the first time I ever ranked on that list. Pretty impressive. It also shared the 1979 Palme d'Or with the Tin Drum. That was only a few months before it actually got a full release, and it wasn't even finished when they screened it in France. And it was 4th of the 1979 U.S. box office. Kramer vs. Kramer, which won the Best Picture Oscar that year, was number 1. Rocky 2 was number 3, and Alien was number 6. So some red-letter films all there, including Apocalypse Now. But okay, Bev Ellis, you're up.
It's a masterpiece. I don't love everything about it.
I'm surprised you say that.
Really? I don't know why you are. I never watched it for a long time. I think when I was young, it was kind of ruined for me by, like...
The bros again?
The bros, the nerdy philosophy the majors Star Wars trying Raiders, to impress Apocalypse me. Now, yeah, trifecta. Yeah, exactly. They kind of...
All the Harrison Ford movies. People ruined them for
That's
you.
So true. I think it kind of lends itself to that first year university overthinking things. It lays it on really thick, and that turned me off back then. I don't like the beginning. I don't like the end. But that trip up the river is like nothing else in cinema. You've pointed out before that a lot of the films on the AFI's list deal with the topic of insanity and have mentally ill characters, but I can't think of any other film, and many try, that so successfully conjure the feeling of going mad for the viewer. And it's such an immersive experience, and I was so caught up in the feeling. It's not a nice feeling, but damn, it is effective. I'm surprised that it's in the 30s now. I'm surprised it's going down, period, and not gaining esteem. Maybe Redux didn't do it any favors.
Well, I'm on the record saying it's one of my favorite films. If I had to name one film, I have a hard time doing that to name four. It's Jaws, Apocalypse Now, It's Wonderful Life, Citizen Kane, and probably 50 or 60 or 7,000 other ones that I would love to watch over and over again. But the one I'd want to study the most and watch the most, the Desert Island movie you can get the most out of, because I've seen Jaws so often, I don't know if I have to get that much more out of it, I think it'd be this one. And it's because it's flawed. I think it's because the movie didn't work as well as it should have. Everybody in the world wanted this movie to be the answer to Vietnam. Francis Ford Coppola's masterpiece after the guy made The Fucking Godfather and The Fucking Godfather Part 2. He wasn't likely to ever eclipse those two films. He probably didn't. But I would rather watch this movie than those two any day of the week. And those are great movies, no doubt about that.
You know, the Godfather movies are absolutely perfect. They're meticulous. But they're intellectual, where Apocalypse Now hits these emotional notes that are transcendent and unmatched in the Godfather films and most films.
This movie is a Jackson Pollock painting compared to that very particular, specific style of painting. And there's all kinds of styles of paintings. I don't know shit about painting. But I do know that Jackson Pollock's paintings give the attitude of, I'm just dripping this all over the place. And of course, it was more than that. But those paintings do come across as some kind of accident. And this movie sort of does too, even though there's all this preparation and everything else that goes into any movie you make. The Godfather films, for all of their problems, especially the first one, Coppola struggled with getting his cast, he struggled with the studio all the time. Godfather 2 was much smoother. But those movies were child's play compared to what he went through to make this movie. Yeah. He lost 100 pounds out in the Philippines jungles. He nearly lost his mind. He maybe never made a good movie again, a truly good movie. He's made lots of movies since. People like The Outsiders, Tucker, The Man in His Dream, Jeff Bridges is fun in that movie. Bram Stoker's Dracula with Gary Oldman, Winona Ryder, and all that great cast, apart from Keanu Reeves. And now he's making personal films again, which he wanted to do all along anyway, and yet most of his classic movies were adapted from books. But isn't it ironic that his most famous films, his best-known films, he adapted Patton as a screenplay, his first AFI film. We've covered him so often. We've mentioned all those actors in the beginning, Ford, Brando, Duvall, Hopper. We've covered them so often in the whole project, but especially Coppola and Harrison Ford lately, and Ford with a few more to go. Coppola wrote Patton, produced American Graffiti. He directed and wrote Godfather. He directed, produced, and wrote Godfather Part 2. And now those three jobs on this movie, and also wrote some of the music. He sent his own money into the project. He had the studio, Zoetrope, that he tried to make work. It didn't really work, unfortunately. It maybe didn't go bankrupt after this, but didn't get helped. And probably lost something of himself in that jungle. People say that Francis Ford Coppola, that we love in the 70s, died in that jungle. That had to happen for him to give this movie, as imperfect as it is. Sorry, Francis, but I'll take it. Because the movie in the Jackson Pollock kind of way works so well for me.
Joseph Heller has this great quote that I'm sure I've said in a podcast before. And Joseph Heller wrote my favorite book, Catch 22. And once upon a time, somebody had the gall to say to him, "Hey, Mr. Heller, you've never written anything as good as Catch 22 ever again in your whole career." And his response was, "Well, neither has anybody else." When you have made one of the greatest movies in history, do you need to outdo that? If he was just a filmmaker that had only made Tucker, The Man in His Dream, and The Rainmaker, like, you know, they may not be the world's greatest films, but but they're solid, good films. Yeah. It wouldn't be a horrible career by any means. But Apocalypse Now has raised the bar for himself and everybody else.
All right, so you didn't like the ending. A lot of people have said that. You said you didn't like the beginning either. Explain the beginning part first. Most people would say, I'm all in from this beginning, because it is one of the most captivating opening 10 or 15 minutes of any movie, or certainly the opening 5 minutes would be.
It just lays it on a little thick. The voiceover kind of sounds like dorm room poetry.
Oh, man. I think it's the best narration of all time in any movie. Goodfellas is certainly in that running. Shawshank Redemption is too. But to me, this is the best narration there's ever been.
Even visually, all the layering. It's a lot to throw your audience into right off the bat. Because when he does that same sort of thing later in the film, I'm all in at that point, and I love it and I'm feeling it. And I don't even notice that all this weird shit is happening. There's people doing Tai Chi on the boat and there's flare smoke everywhere. And I'm like, yes, yes, I'm there. But when it happens right out of the gate. But I mean, that's just my opinion, obviously.
Did you read the story about how the movie opened with an improv? Coppola says on the commentary, with all the special features came out, and the Blu-ray has even more special features. I meant to watch them before this. I meant to watch Hearts of Darkness before this. Great documentary that his wife, Eleanor, shot. Hickenlooper and Barr. Oh, I forget their names now. But they made this movie in 91, one of the great films of that year, one of the great documentaries of all time, for sure.
The greatest on-set documentary about a making of a film.
And this is what I heard on the commentary that's on the DVD. The Blu-ray's got it too. The opening kind of came out of nowhere. They were editing the film. It was 200 plus hours of production. Let's get the editing credits right now.
Walter Murch! The sound genius,
The sound genius on The Godfather, and he also worked on American Graffiti. He worked with Coppola plenty of times.
And he wasn't just a sound genius. He is considered one of the greatest editors who's ever worked in Hollywood, and he wrote the Bible on editing that just about all of us have read. It's called In the Blink of an Eye, and he's our hero.
And Gerald Greenberg worked on The French Connection, and a woman named Lisa Fruchtman, who worked on The Right Stuff a few years after this. They all worked on this movie. I'm sure dozens of other people probably helped out. But anyway, Coppola found outtakes of the bombing. They love the smell of napalm in the morning scene. When they firebomb the trees, they gas them so they can fucking surf. We'll get to that whole sequence soon. And the close-ups of the helicopters going by with that surround sound effect, one of the most effective openings. Okay, maybe you didn't like the opening itself, but that first 30 seconds to a minute, you had to have liked that, where you hear the helicopter going through a whole living room from the left to the right, behind us, in front of us, and then they bomb the trees, and then the ironic opening, and Coppola apparently thought of this too, starting a movie with the end, the song, the great song by the Doors.
Look, I'm not going to disparage the technique that was used. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying when you have perfection as your bar, when you have the genius, unparalleled masterpiece that is the middle of the film to compare it to, it's just not up to par with that.
I don't agree at all. I think that's a great opening. I know. I'm a little biased, though, because this is one of my favorite films. In that opening, though, Willard, we meet him for the first time. Martin Sheen's in the movie long before Brando. Brando only appears in the last maybe 30 minutes or so. We hear his voice early on, though. Colonel Kurtz in this movie is mentioned over and over and over again before we ever see anything more than a picture of him.
The buildup is massive.
And then when they get there, they get Marlon Brando. We're going to talk about that soon. Duvall as Kilgore is barely in the movie. The movie belongs to Martin Sheen. Does he foresee everything that's to come? Or is the idea that, much like in Taxi Driver, one of Coppola's buddies, Martin Scorsese, he and Paul Schrader said the Taxi Driver movie could have been made into a loop. He cut up some of the beginning and some of the ending. Mm-hmm. Travis Bickle's going to do this shit all over again. Maybe he won't last all the time. He'll eventually die. But Martin Sheen's character waking up, Saigon. Shit. I'm still only in Saigon. He's been an assassin before. He's killed these people. He's going to kill other ones in the future, although he does say he's not in their fucking army anymore. But what does that really mean? Is this movie the same thing where if you could have some of the beginning and some of the end, he could have another breakdown in some other hotel, in some other place, maybe Saigon, maybe not, where he continues this loop until he eventually does buy it. Either his brain explodes and he can't do this anymore, or he literally dies in battle.
Well, the voiceover is sometimes in past tense, so the suggestion is that we already know that the mission has been accomplished and he has survived. Or it could be that he has some kind of foresight. There is definitely a kind of supernatural vibe to this film. It gets more so as it goes deeper into the jungle.
The further it goes in the jungle, incidentally, did you notice, the less high-tech it gets.
Yeah, it gets, it's almost like it's going back in time.
One of the deleted sequences and Apocalypse Now Redux famously had this long sequence which does not fit. It really kills the movie because they get off the fucking boat. Chef says to them at one point, never get out of the boat. And that's a mistake in this movie. Whenever they get off the boat, that's when the movie loses momentum. But in that sequence, they meet the French plantation people and they're in Cambodia. They're way past the Dolong Bridge. Clean ends up getting killed past Dolong. They bury him. They meet the French people. You shouldn't be here. French failed to get this and you're fighting for nothing. And Martin has experiences he doesn't need to have, which is making love to a woman. This guy's fucked up. He's gone. The opening of the movie presents the idea that, kind of like Bickle, he can't be normal.
He's done for it before he even leaves.
And there's another deleted sequence in Apocalypse Now Redux. And by the way, let me backtrack a minute. I saw Apocalypse Now Redux on the big screen in the IMAX big screen. Maybe it wasn't an IMAX presentation, but it was that size of screen. With all of its flaws, it was still the best movie I saw that year in 2001. But the French plantation sequence doesn't help. The playmate sequence where they have them later on, Martin Sheen's exchanging fuel for some time for the boys with the women. He steals Kilgore's surfboard. And then we see more of Brando. I don't think any of that helps the movie. I think all of it makes the movie worse, but it's still a brilliant film with its flaws. Because the Brando bullshit didn't help the movie in the first place, and then the additional things that they cut out, that they should have cut out. I don't know why Coppola thought, let's make a new movie again. No, I don't think he needed to.
They probably just wanted to make a lot of money, and having new footage, especially back in 2001 when DVDs and all their extras were all the rage, yeah. And studios were suddenly like, oh my god, we can capitalize on all these movies we thought we were done making a fortune from by adding weird deleted scenes. Apocalypse Now is such a revered film with such a tremendous legacy. I don't think that Coppola thinks he made a mistake taking these scenes out. The theatrical cut still stands as his film. It's not like Spielberg or Lucas where they went back and they said, no, this is the film I always wanted to make. It was more this extra, a director's cut, which I am never a fan of director's cuts. I am always pro-theatrical cut.
Have you seen Redux?
No.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about, though? Have you read about it in your research?
Yes.
The first one that I think hurts the movie the most, we get into Kilgore. We meet him long before we meet Kurtz. The obvious, not very subtle idea is that if he's going to fight the war this way, then why do they have anything against Kurtz? And in fact, that's what Willard even says in voiceover. Kilgore kills many people. He attacks a village with school children. Now, maybe they're harboring Viet Cong. We don't know. That's very possible. But what we see, the movie presents it very plainly, is that these kids at dawn are just doing their thing. And then dun da da dun 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 dun. Just for two things. One is so these motherfuckers can surf. And the second is so they can get their stupid Vietnam mission in there to go and kill one guy. Like I said in my nutshell, the death of the one outweighs the needs of the many. And I said many, meaning the boat. I mean, God, we lose a few people from our main cast on the boat. Never mind the Viet Cong, the South Vietnamese, the Cambodians, all these other people who died just for that one guy.
Mm-hmm. Just to kill that one guy.
Mm-hmm. But that's the most famous sequence in the whole film. And Duvall's great speech towards the end of it. My favorite line in the whole sequence is actually, someday this war is going to end.
Most poignant line in his whole speech.
I think it's way more important than the napalm in the morning. And John Milius, who was a co-writer with Coppola on this film, thought that we could cut out in a second, and that being one of the most famous lines in film history.
They leave it kind of ambiguous, but I think it's safe for anyone to assume Kilgore is bummed that this war is going to end.
That's the look he has on his face.
Right.
Someday this war is going to end. I don't want to end. I'm good at this. I love doing this. He would kill thousands more people, even if it just meant, because I feel like it. Because I want to surf today. The next mission I get from that Trang is some other ridiculous thing. I don't even understand. I don't care. Oh, let's go kill the other school out there so we can have steaks or something. It doesn't matter to him.
And their opponents are completely outmatched. They show up with helicopters. They even have those jets that fly in when it's like, oh, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. All right, call the Air Force. They'll just come napalm the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And earlier when he's throwing the playing cards on the corpses, there's women. There's children. There are innocents. He doesn't care. He has his job and it's fun and then they succeed and then he gets promoted and they get to go surfing and then they have a little beach party and everybody wins. As far as he's concerned, he's completely dehumanized the enemy that much.
But when he says someday this war is going to end, the movie in Redux continues. Come on, get out there and surf. Lions, go out there. We get the point already. And then Willard leads this little raid to steal the surfboard. And he's with the guys. He's connecting with these guys. He never connects them in any other part of the movie.
Yeah.
And he's laughing. He's smiling. That character is fucked before the movie started. He was fucked maybe years before this, certainly weeks or months before this. He's never going to be normal again. He's never going to be human again. And we see him do a human thing, much like the playmate sequence. I don't know why Coppola and Murch decided to do that. I think they destroy their main character with that one moment alone. And they also hurt probably the most famous character from this film, because as much as people know about Brando, and obviously they know Martin Sheen, he's in almost every scene in the whole movie, people usually talk about Kilgore, Duvall's character, the most. And they ruin it by having him go on some more, and then later on, even though it's funny, before they go into the forest to get the mangoes, the reason why they're hiding out, if you look closely, you can see the surfboard on the boat. They're hiding out because there's this helicopter. Several of them, sure. They're going over the river. And it's a recorded message from Kilgore saying, Lance, give back the surfboard. I swear I won't kill you. I won't hurt you. It was a good board, Lance. And it's funny. but it doesn't fit the tone. Okay, that fits the tone of this movie, actually, to be fair.
It fits Kilgore's character, but not Willer's.
And that also does hurt Kilgore, though, too, yeah. because he has that last line. He gets up, he walks away, and this war's going to end. No more. And I think I've said enough about this. I'll say no more.
I have more to say on
this. I might too, actually, but go ahead.
Okay, well, mostly just about Willard's character and how he has to remain consistent. And part of the reason why it's important that he is so detached and so destroyed at the beginning of the film is because he's our observer. He has to be the one who sits back and watches everybody else go mad. But the only way that he can do that is because at the beginning of the film, he's already completely destroyed. And that point is laboriously made at the beginning of the film with his breakdown, with his need for another mission, with his description of his detachment from anything back home, and the difficulty that the soldiers have just getting him to come to meet the officers and get his new mission, where they talk about how this isn't even the first time he's had a mission like this, where he's assassinated somebody.
That's why they pick him. Thing. He may be good at assassinating people. He's better at keeping his mouth shut.
Right, and he doesn't connect with anybody else. He doesn't even react to most of what's going on. That's because he's already been through all of it and he's ruined. So when they go mad, he stays sane. Sort of.
Well, yeah, he doesn't change, I guess. He doesn't really have an arc.
He doesn't change, yeah.
Sheen gives a great performance despite the fact he doesn't really have a traditional arc.
But he has to be the cipher for the audience in that manner so that we can kind of observe it through him. When you talk about at the beginning that, is this a loop? Is this something that's just going to happen over and over again? Maybe it is something that will happen over and over again because Coppola is making a statement about human nature.
Yeah.
That the heart of darkness is just the heart of nature, human nature, nature. It's all evil. It all ultimately leads to evil and selfishness and complete removal from what we think makes us human.
One of the theories that Werner Herzog, the documentarian, has is that nature is an evil, awful place. Not humans, but animals.
How is that even a theory? I feel like that's just most plain people don't ever
put that. People put that out there all the time, that animals are just doing their thing and we don't have any problem. Lion King. Well, we kill them and they kill this thing and that feeds the grass and that's the circle of life. Which is a nice way of saying everybody's savage, everything is savage and killing everything else.
This movie kind of forces you to ask that question. Why are you rooting for the Americans? You shouldn't root for our heroes because they're doing terrible things. But then at the same time, do you root for the tiger that tries to kill Chef and Willard? Do you root for the disease that could kill somebody? We try to inoculate our children against these diseases. Mm-hmm. And do you root for that? Nature is cruel. They keep going back in time, like you said, up the river. Towards the true nature of nature.
And a country that was supposed to be in Cambodia, which is part of the scandal of this too, because Nixon apparently was ready to bomb Cambodia during the war, as in nuclear bomb maybe. And it's bad enough to suggest that in Vietnam, where they're actually fighting, there's actually, well, then again, declared war. America doesn't declare war, except on drugs in World War II.
Hypocrisy, a major theme of this film. And the one thing Willard and Kurtz will not stand for.
Yeah, they really click all along, those two. That's why Willard sympathizes with Kurtz in the beginning, even says in the voiceover, the voice really put a hook in me. Francis Ford Coppola was asked, is this movie pro-war or anti-war? Most war movies are asked that question. He says the movie's anti-lie, and very few war movies can actually really make that claim, I would say. Because generally, as Francois Truffaut said about movies that are about war, especially American war films, they do tend to make war seem fun. Even the movies that try to be as gritty and awful as possible, Platoon, we're going to cover that in a few months from now. It's one of our last Vietnam films in the project. What we saw, The Aftermath, only The Aftermath and Best Years of Our Lives. We don't see any war in that movie. Last week, The Deer Hunter, we covered that. The awful things these guys go through. We don't even see that much of the war. We see far more of what they go through in the prison camp sequence. But even that is an allegory of the war. All of this stuff can come across as thrilling. The Deer Hunter's on the thrills list. This movie, I don't know why the fuck it isn't, but it's not on the thrills list. I think it should be. Truffaut's point may hold true, but if you make a movie that criticizes the bullshit, not just from America, but from any country about war, then I think you get into the heart of it. And when I mention Saving Private Ryan, I don't necessarily disagree with their decisions in either movie, but the generals in both movies are, let's go in there and send five guys in this movie, and Saving Private Ryan, I think it's six, seven, eight, something like that, I forget, I should know. But anyway, let's send a half dozen people in the other movie and just shy of that in this movie for one person. Kill one and save one. Other. And in both cases, how many people survive from the original mission? Two. Willard and Lance in this movie, and in Saving Private Ryan, spoiler alert, but everyone's seen Saving Private Ryan, it's a huge hit. It isn't the Willard character in that movie, no. Tom Hanks. It's a lesser character, the Ryben, Edward Burns character, and then the interpreter, and of course they do actually manage to save Private Ryan. But in both movies, it's fucking absurd. If you want to win these wars, what in the fuck are you doing? The whole point of winning a war is to kill more of them than they kill of you, to the point where they finally get on their knees and say, "No mas, I give up." When people talk about torture and dungeons and stuff, which is happening right now by America, I don't think it's good. I'm not in favor of it. But when people pull this whole moral, how could you do that stuff? Well, do you want to win the war or not? If you want to win a war, you slaughter as many of their side as possible. And that's what Kurtz gets in this movie. But it also drives him fucking crazy.
As they go up the river, part of what they're doing is stripping away all the rationalizations that we all use for war. You know, all those guys in the first segment, they all believe that they're fighting for America. They all really still have a piece of America with them. They still have that brotherhood. They're having the party on the beach and
beers and steaks.
Yeah, home. They're fighting for good.
Let's still play a German composer when we go into war against them, yes, ironically. Yeah.
And then as they get to the second part, which is the USO show, things are starting to fall apart there. Mm-hmm. And then they suddenly aren't brothers anymore. They're turning against each other. They're turning more into animals and going after the girls in the show. And still rationalizing their behavior, but more so for their own sake, rationalizing with their selfish desires. When you get to the third spot, Dolung Bridge, everything's pure madness. There's no leadership. It's like a brain without an ego. It's just pure id, and people are afraid or they're catatonic.
No one's even in charge.
Yeah, it's a theory apparently that Roach was the commanding officer, but he went mad. And just decided to fight with all the rest of the guys and stop giving orders.
You know who's in command here? Yeah.
Exactly. Because it's him. Maybe. I mean, that's a theory. And interesting, by the way, that as they get to the most dangerous part and the most pointless battle, where they burn the bridge down every night and build it back up, that's where you see all the black soldiers. Because apparently that's what the American military did, is they put their minority soldiers in the most dangerous places. Yeah, it's terrible. I remember noticing in the film and kind of finding it at least refreshing that there was a lot more diversity in this film. Even in 79, there's not that much diversity. Oh, it's nice to see that there's these speaking parts, these really interesting characters that aren't all white men. But
40% of our boat characters are black guys, like Fishburne and Albert Hall. And then, in that sequence in Dolung Bridge, you've got a lot of guys huddled together. We said it when it happened in the movie that as Willard and Lance walk along and they see these guys just sitting there, they're not doing anything wrong. But as the light goes in and out, and you see these guys just sitting there, it's eerie. It's almost like a horror film kind of thing. If David Lynch was in charge of this, he would have made that even weirder than it already was. It's not because they're black, it's because they're just sitting there so serene. And yet you hear this other guy, this Vietnamese guy on the other side of the bridge, "Fuck you, G.I.!" The whole sequence until Roach kills him, it's "Fuck you!" And explosions everywhere. The carnival music, do you notice that?
Yes.
Circus kind of music playing underneath it as well. Yeah. And then Lance is high on acid, so he's seeing all kinds of weird colors, and he's probably right for the pickings and somehow survives this whole movie. He probably should die.
Everything about that scene is so surreal. He's on acid, so it's like that psychedelic feel. And this was still the 70s, so I'm sure that people still just thought it was bar.
You know what's funny? I just realized this right now. Willard says about Kilgore, "You just knew he'd get through this world without so much as a scratch." Okay, he and Lance don't have that much in common, despite the surfing thing. Of course, they have that in common. Lance is not a bad person. He seems like a nice young kid. But in this whole movie, he gets out with so much of a scratch. He's spaced out, but you feel like he could recover and lead a normal life again and be a surfer back there. Okay, possibly. Of the five guys in our movie, three of them are dead, and the other one is already fucked up to begin with, and that's Willard. But Lance and Kilgore conceivably could escape this war without so much as a scratch.
Lance is the only one of the other guys who gets out of the boat at every stop and really commits to what's going on everywhere. He's Kilgore's little buddy in the first stop. He is throwing beer cans and swearing at the playmates at the USO show. He's high on acid with a puppy in his jacket, taking everything in at the bridge.
And then gets full native when Chief dies and gives him this weird water burial with the arrow stuck in his head still, which he had done jokingly earlier before Chief actually gets a real spear through his chest.
Incredible.
And still has that weird, goofy, comic Steve Martin kind of thing with the arrow through the head.
He's mad, and he is not coming back.
But physically, at least, he's not suffered so much as a scratch.
No, that's true.
And yet, the two black characters die. And isn't it interesting that our boat characters, the five of them, represent America? We don't know where the chief, Phillips, is from. The other four guys, Willard's from Ohio, the Midwest. Lance is from California. Shep is from New Orleans, the South. And Mr. Clean, Larry Fishburne, is from the Bronx. So they represent all four corners of the country, in effect. The Willard, Kurtz, and Kilgore characters do not represent Vietnam soldiers, probably any soldiers, but especially Vietnam soldiers. It is the Lance B. Johnsons from nowhere who don't know what the fuck they're doing, why they're even there in the first place, and get spaced out on drugs and the Mr. Cleans, who were too young to be there. Larry Fishburne was actually only 14. We keep calling him Larry because he was Larry back then.
Yeah, that's how they credited him.
He's supposed to be 17, even says so. And before the movie was actually finished, I think he turned 17. But he started shooting this movie before he was even 15 fucking years old. Unbelievable. And then Chef Frederick Forrest, a guy who worked with Coppola a lot of times. I think the unsung hero of this cast, actually. He almost survives to the words the end. And in his famous line, never got out of the boat after the tiger thing. He pretty much stays in the boat until the end of the movie. We don't see it, but where does he probably get killed? On the boat.
Yeah, of course.
He's supposed to call in the airstrike, and he's about to talk to command. PBR street gang, come in, over. And the next time we see him, he's just a head. And Kurtz's MO of taking heads seems to have filled out yet again, because he drops in Willard's lap to say, eh, your guy's dead, you're not calling an airstrike on me. He's ready for this.
Oh,
the irony of sending a guy in a boat, sneak in there and kill Kurtz. And they tell him during the mission that we already sent a guy in anyway, Scott Glenn. We saw him in Nashville, where he was a sorrowful soldier. He had that beautiful moment at the end of Nashville where he can't save his hero, Barbara Jean. And of course, he's the FBI director in Silence of the Lambs. Three really good AFI movies, and not really a strong part of any one of them. He doesn't even have any lines in this movie. He's the Jeff Goldblum of this film. But he was sent in before, and he becomes part of the group. We see other guys in soldier's gear. It could be his people. It could have been Brando's other guys, maybe a combination of the two. If they just kept sending boats of people, and if Kurtz wanted to keep on fighting them off and living, he would just keep on whacking them over and over and over. They would never, ever take him out. The only reason he dies at the end is because he's willing to, and as Willard's voiceover even says, even the jungle wanted him dead, and that's who he took his order from anyway. Because there's no way with all those people that two or three or even five guys in our boat had survived, they were ever going to get in there and kill him.
Yeah, that's why I say there's something kind of supernatural about Kurtz. It's almost as if when Kurtz got to the end of the river and reached the heart of darkness, if you will, it possessed him.
Oh, you think he's talking about Willard living kills on in a second kind of life, well, or something?
Well, more like when Willard kills him, he takes over. There's something about reaching this apex of evil, and he could only tolerate it for so long, so he lets Willard take his place.
The movie suggests that if Willard wanted to, he easily could have been their new god. Yeah. They even drop their weapons when he drops his machete, but he, of course, goes off a lance. The movie ends with the horror of the horror, and it's so open-ended. And a lot of people hated that ending. I think that's the point of this movie. Yes, Coppola had to improvise because Brando was overweight. He was unprepared. He didn't read Heart of Darkness, the novel by Joseph Conrad. The novel. The novel. That didn't help. Brando was a fucking asshole. Although, ironically, when you get to the end of this, isn't it funny, isn't it right, I guess, that you find the iconic actor of the century? That's what you find. And he doesn't live up to your expectations. I think that's why the movie works. I think it works. They got so lucky that Brando didn't act like a professional and get in better shape and know his lines and know the book that you should have fucking read. It wouldn't take that long to do that. This is a method actor guy. Method acting is all about knowing the character, getting into skin, which is all about preparation. We talked about De Niro on some of his movies, Taxi Driver, Godfather Part 2, and Deer Hunter, and certainly Raging Bull, where he does all this research, and all the other method actors do the same thing. But didn't they get lucky by the fact that just like Vietnam, they wanted to be World War II all over again? Nope. You lose and you pull out, unlike what Nixon said, without honor. Because you are a turning tail, because you realize you can't fucking win over there. And it's the same kind of thing with Willard. He does complete his mission, and it doesn't really achieve anything anyway. And then when he gets there, the thing I felt much stronger than fear was a desire to confront him. The desire to meet the greatest actor of a generation, and for him not to live up to your expectations.
Okay, so here's my question. Do you think for Willard that Kurtz meets his expectations? Do you think Willard is disappointed by Kurtz?
Yes!
What?
Because the character in the book is supposed to be a madman who's starving. Of course, Brando is grossly overweight. But I kind of like that incongruity that all of them are starving.
Okay, I've never read the book, and I don't think that Coppola is making a true adaptation of the book anyway.
No, they did branch off in many cases.
So, that being said, Coppola's intentions in mind, do you think that Willard is disappointed about what he finds in Kurtz? I did not see that at all.
Well, it's funny how he does say that he wants to confront him, and yet he really doesn't even speak to him through much of the movie. You would think that
he confronts him by killing him.
But he's in there for days. I was not under guard. Do they really talk that much? We hear Brando's ramblings, which I love. I think they're fucking great. The guy improv. He was just being a dickwad piece of shit. And yet I think it works because the guy's insane. But the actor is maybe starting to go a little insane. He didn't care about what he was doing in the business anymore. He didn't have any respect for this movie, it seems, certainly in the end. We watched a documentary at Hot Docs called Listen to Me, Marlon. Mm. We recently saw Last Days in Vietnam. And that encapsulates all this stuff. Brando slammed what Coppola said about how I had this fat actor, I had to cover him in darkness and all this stuff. And Brando says it was his idea to shoot him in darkness. Whoever's idea it was, I think it works. don't show this guy. Have this massive screen. Don't forget, I saw this on the IMAX screen. This enormous head, which just takes up a sliver, a tiny part of the screen, which is so weird and so bizarre. It shouldn't have been that way, but I think it works in spite of itself.
So Willer may have been disappointed by Marlon Brando, but you sure as hell weren't.
Anybody who doesn't like the end of this movie, I'm not going to tell them that they're wrong. It's like the ending of Lost. But if you read into what you want to, and any movie or any TV show always gives you that opportunity, read into what you want of it. Vietnam petered out. This movie peters out. Dennis Hopper's character even says it. He's quoting a famous novel, but this is the way the fucking world ends, man. Not with a bang, with a fucking whimper. With a whimper, I'm fucking splitting, Jack. The movie ends that way.
You know what Apocalypse Now reminded me of? Another movie that I think is also based on a Joseph Conrad novel, Aguirre, Wrath of God. Is that based on a Conrad novel?
I always call that movie Apocalypse Before.
That's right, you do. I read that there's a deleted scene in Apocalypse Now where they pass a ship.
A monkey sampan.
And it's full of monkeys, just like at the end of Aguirre, Wrath of God, which I know is a little bit of an obscure reference.
That's more than 40 years ago, though.
Yeah, and it's also German? It's
a Herzog. Well, we said Herzog. Yeah, there is not a documentary, but an actual fictional movie based on the El Dorado search, the City of Lost Gold.
And one of my favorite things about Aguirre, Wrath of God that bears a large resemblance to Apocalypse Now is that it really ends with a whimper. And I think I could have seen Apocalypse Now ending with more of a whimper, but obviously this is up for debate and you totally disagree with me.
The ending of the movie, according to John Milius' conception, was supposed to be that Willard and Kurtz are fighting off the airstrike. And Kurtz apparently says, I can feel the power in my loins. And Coppola thought that was absurd. Incidentally, there's a documentary, another one we're going to mention here, called Milius, about John Milius, who last I heard couldn't speak because he had throat cancer, probably from smoking too much, unfortunately. Great rock on tour. It's one of the unfortunate tragedies of that situation. Yes, he survived, at least he hasn't died from cancer. But a guy who's so great at telling stories can't speak. But Coppola's in that movie saying, everything memorable about Apocalypse Now is written by John Milius.
Hmm.
Which is saying a lot, considering Coppola had co-written with other people, Puzo and the Godfather films, and Patton with Edmund H. North, but still was a part of Oscar-winning screenplays, these great scripts, and then his own script on The Conversation in 74. But Milius had the ideas of the surfing and the water skiing and all the crazy shit. This movie was supposed to be made by him writing it, and then George Lucas directing it in the mid-70s, but they were going to do it in Vietnam as if it was a pseudo-documentary kind of thing. The kind of thing we see on the faux documentaries we see now.
16 mil.
Right. During the war. But then the war ended, and they thought, we can want to do this. And Lucas was going on to make Star Wars because he finally got that greenlit after the success of American Graffiti, which Coppola produced. Look at all these connections we have here. And after Coppola did The Conversation and The Godfather Part II the same year and was nominated for so many awards, made so much money, he was the king of the world, way more than James Cameron ever was. He realized what the potential was for this movie, which wasn't called Apocalypse Now at that point. Milius is the one who coined that. There were buttons out there the hippies were wearing called Nirvana Now.
Yeah.
Let's go with the reverse of Apocalypse Now. And you do see that title on the screen. This is such an unusual movie because there are no end credits, the version that we saw, the version you should watch, and there's no opening credits. But the title is in the movie when Dennis Hopper first appears, and you see written on the wall in graffiti, our motto, Apocalypse Now. A few more things about Milius. He is the inspiration for the Walter character, John Goodman, in The Big Lebowski, because he was friends with the Coen brothers. And he is a gun nut, which seems appropriate. We saw gun nuts last week in The Deer Hunter, rednecks who happen to get guns over Vietnam and bad things happen. And there's a lot of guns in this movie, obviously. Pretty decent filmmaker. Not one of those guys you put in that upper class as a writer or director, but at least he was involved in this one AFI movie as a writer. The AFI Top 100 Quotes list. And the songs list. We've talked about them both so often. Let me rattle off some things that are so absent on those lists. Charlie Don't Surf. How is that not one of the quotes?
I don't get it. Charlie Don't Surf. What was I missing?
Well, Charlie is the slang for the Viet Cong.
Oh!
But here's a subtext. I'm going to mention this book. I'm holding it right in my hands right now. Maybe I'll take a picture of it and put it on the website. Carl French wrote this little novella type thing. I mentioned it on Jaws. I have the Alien book and the Jaws book and this one. I wish I'd bought the ones for both Blue Velvet and the Bond movies. I think there's six of them in total, but those ones anyway. In that, he talks about how Charlie Don't Surf refers to the actual Viet Cong, but also Charlie Manson, Charles Manson. The movie actually sets itself, not literally ever saying what year it is, but we see Chef, when they go through the mail, saying that the Manson trial was going on, but that would have been in 69. So I guess the movie's set in 1969. So Charlie Don't Surf, which is this weird connection to what's happening back home, this slaughtering, murdering bastard. Well, that's what the Americans, and really everybody in that war, are as well. What the fuck are any of us doing surfing when we're killing? So there's that incongruity of anybody doing this, whether it be Americans or Vietnamese or anybody, surfing or ever having fun, which also ties in the whole voiceover line that Willard has about how Charlie didn't get much R&R. All he wanted was a little rice and rat meat, because the only way home is death or victory. And in that sequence, Another one I think could have been cut out. We talked about how Redux had pretty much no additions that I think made the movie better. But something that's in every version of Apocalypse Now is the USO sequence. There's nothing wrong with it, but I don't think it adds anything to the movie. Seeing the women is a great thing because we really otherwise barely see women in this whole movie. And when they are, they're just subservient women that get killed on a boat in the My Lai Massacre sort of situation where Mr. Clean goes crazy for no reason whatsoever and they kill them all. And then in the compound at the end. Maybe that's why the USO sequence is there, to show these pretty women. And then immediately these guys ruin it. It's within minutes that they're just getting the fuck out of there.
I disagree. I think that scene has a ton of value. I think that scene is a demonstration that the men have now turned on each other. Initially, we see them turning on the enemy. They get to the USO show and they're dehumanizing each other and they only look out for themselves. I think that's what that scene demonstrates very powerfully. That's an incredible scene. It's kind of terrifying what those guys are doing. And these are your heroes. These are the people that you're rooting for. And even Lance is taking part in this, and so is Chef.
I won't disagree with that, but I think in a movie that's already debatably too long, not the longer version, but the 2.5 hour version that we watched, if you're going to cut anything as far as a whole section, I think that could go.
I would say if I had to cut out a scene, aside from the fact that it's drop-dead gorgeous and some of the most beautiful scenes ever put on film.
Mangoes?
The mangoes, yeah. I like it, but I think that the USO scene serves a greater purpose.
Maybe the mangoes doesn't really add that much. Maybe the idea is that it has to be this breather we get after... Dun, 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 dun. Because we don't really learn anything about Chef we need to know. He wants to be a saucier, and we see these enormous, these fucking
massive trees.
Blue filter. Vittorio Storaro, one of the best looking movies that's ever been shot, won the Oscar for won the Oscar for Reds, won the Oscar for The Last Emperor. Didn't make any other AFI movies, though. It's the only one he ever made. But sometimes it's just a matter of shooting what's actually there and lighting it with filters and making it look so bizarre. Also, at one point, Willard and Chef are kind of 90 degrees away from each other. It seems like it's some kind of weird...
It's like an alien landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And then this alien beast comes from nowhere. We think of tigers. We know they exist, but they're kind of zoo animals. For them to just be there to treat us like
never
prey...
Never before or since in the movie either.
Yeah, and it's nature turning on them as well. I think it plays well into that theme that nature is, in some way, the heart of darkness.
And then they get back at animals by killing the water buffalo at the end. The Ifugao people in the Philippines killed this water buffalo. There's many stories about this, actually. There are people that say that Coppola set this all up, and there are other stories. His wife, Eleanor, says that they were going to do this anyway, so it was her idea, and Francis bought into this. Let's shoot this, and this can be our comparison. They slaughter this animal, and they'll have Sam Bottoms be part of that, and that contrasts with Willard killing Kurtz, both of them being sliced and slaughtered. And it is interesting, too, that we know it's real, so we see an animal so rarely in any Hollywood movie being killed right then and there. I remember when I first saw this movie, I assumed it wasn't real. But now knowing that, it's pretty chilling.
One of the reasons that I haven't watched this film in the last 2 decades really all that much is because I'm just such a softie for animals. And there's that scene, and there's the scene where the puppy gets lost. That right there is part of the hypocrisy of it all, that people would get so outraged. And people did get outraged that an animal got slaughtered in this film. But that outrage isn't extended to all the people that you see get slaughtered in the film. People will react to the puppy going missing.
Well, because nobody actually got slaughtered for real in the film, unlike the
water buffalo. No, I know, but I think you see my point. I was so troubled by the puppy scene, even though both the scene where they discover the puppy and the scene where the puppy goes missing, there's real heartbreaking human carnage. Yeah. There's either a whole family getting killed for no reason, or there's the teenager that gets killed right at the same time that the dog goes missing. The dog that doesn't even have a name. How you could get attached to this animal considering all the human carnage that's going on.
Dog?
Yeah, it's part of the hypocrisy as well.
Yeah. All right, I started this section by talking about quotes. Let's try to burn through these without taking too much time on.
No more sighs. No more sighs.
Well, the sighs are good. But anyway, so Duvall says Charlie don't surf. He also says, do these people ever give up? Which is racist, of course. These people is meant to be, these fucking Vietnamese. But also, I think that's the point. It's one of the dumbest questions ever asked. I don't think Kilgore's stupid. You're in their land.
I know.
They're not going to give up. Of course they're not going to give up.
You're blowing up their school, their village. You're tearing down their little thatchet hutches with your tank.
And what follows Duvall's famous Napalm in the Morning line is that smell, that gasoline smell. And the whole little speech he gives to Wilder is all about how they naped a hill and they couldn't find not one stinking dink body. Which, of course, is racist, too. What does that say? You're fighting for a hill that no one wants, which later in the movie, the French sequence that got cut out of the film, that guy even says to Sheen, you are fighting for the biggest nothing in the history of anything. Although many people have said that America at least trying to stop communism in Southeast Asia was important to at least make that effort. I don't know. I'm not going to get into the whole politics of that. Of course, so many Vietnamese, unfortunately, Cambodians too, and Americans died for what seems to have been a war that achieved nothing because they just pulled out. The other line that leads out of the Duvall sequences, the bullshit stacked so high in Vietnam, you needed wings to stay above it.
Yeah.
To me, that's a double meaning. Well, you needed wings to stay above it because it's so high. But also because only as an angel, only as a dead person, can you get out of the bullshit of this war.
Right before that, he says something I really like. Charging a man with murder in this place was like handing out speeding tickets at the Indy 500. Mm-hmm. But I really like that image of the angel flying above to get out of the bullshit.
And in our mission, the five main characters, who are the three that die? Two black guys and the southern redneck. Not the Midwestern all-American boy who's also leader of our mission, and not the Californian surfer, as a subtext.
What is the subtext?
That the black guys and the rednecks are the ones who die. They're the ones that pay with blood.
It's a criticism of the American military that it is... Yeah. Okay.
That still exists even now. The nobodies who go over to fight for their country, the ones who get whacked. I just want to learn to fucking cook, man! I just want to fucking cook, man! I love his performance. I think he's the best thing in this movie, maybe acting-wise, even though Duvall gets all the credit.
There's some stiff competition for the best thing in this movie.
Wow. Acting-wise. He's the unsung hero at the very least, I'll say.
Okay, okay. So while we're talking about Lance, I want to talk about his acid trip.
Far out.
And that crazy scene on the bridge. Remember I said how, you know, when we're with Kilgore, there's the dehumanization of the enemy. When we're at the USO show, it's the dehumanization of the other soldiers, of everybody else around them. But when you get to the bridge, there is this complete dehumanization of the self. This is the point where they've passed the part of the river, they descend truly into madness. Certainly Lance does, and so much so that he takes drugs, that he gets outside himself, that his whole acid trip becomes externalized in that incredibly breathtaking, beautiful scene.
And then later on, he doesn't even fight for his own commander of the boat. When they capture Willard, he just becomes part of that group.
He's lost.
And I'll say again, I think he still could come out of this if he gets out of his drug trip shit. Just like the Montagnard army could get out of this drug trip shit. Maybe they're on drugs too. Once their leader's dead and this guy who could take over for them drives away in this boat, maybe they're going to finally realize, what are we doing here? Let's go and do something useful. Or let's go fight somebody. Let's go do something awful. We'll do something other than just sit around and be fucking stoned or act stoned.
Presumably, that's their home.
Well, who knows what Kurtz has done as far as taking people from where they don't belong.
Yeah.
We see bodies all along the river right after the Dolong Bridge thing. Things really get surreal. We see the remains of B-52 bombers. And that made me wonder, how many hulking remains of ships and bombs and everything else are in foreign countries all over this world, not just in Vietnam, but Korea, but World War I and II, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, the other Iraq War. How many things that don't belong there are still there to this day?
Apparently in Europe, people still come across active artillery. Yeah.
From way back, nearly 70 years ago. Yeah. All right, so the ending. The horror. That comes out of his inoculation story. One of the things that was contributed by, I think, Michael Hare, the guy who helped write the narration, who also co-wrote Full Metal Jacket with Kubrick, describing how they tried to help young kids inoculate them with polio. Mm-hmm. I discovered they were stronger than we. They had the strength to do that.
Chop children's arms off rather than get them inoculated. They never explain why these guys would have objected to vaccinations.
I think the idea is they didn't know why these guys were putting needle things, these little miniature daggers in somebody's arm, so let's just cut off and make sure.
But what Kurtz values more than anything when he's telling this story about men who are chopping children's arms off, these men are so detached from the actions that they're performing. They're perfect soldiers, and he admires their lack of humanity, and he says that's why they'll win. That makes them stronger.
Particularly because they're hurting their own tribesmen. They're hurting their own children, grandchildren, cousins, neighbors, nephews, because they don't know why these little needles might put on their kids' arms, so let's cut them off to make sure. And as he said, if I had 10 divisions of those men, our troubles would be over very quickly. It reminded me of when Kevin Smith talked about his own father. Kevin Smith, we did Clerks a few weeks ago on the Not 100 Project. Not a filmmaker that would be associated with this movie.
No.
But here's my comparison. He mentioned when his father died a couple of years ago, I think it was, that his brother said he heard his dad screaming before he actually expired. And then I talked about this in one of our podcasts, how it inspired me, because Smith said that because my father died screaming means to me we're all going to die screaming. So I'm going to do the best I can with what I got in the meantime. I'm going to make podcasts. I'm going to make movies. I'm going to do all these things. And that inspired me with our podcast and with my life in general. But that reminds me of the horror of the horror. His father died screaming in pain, and that's what Kurtz goes through too. We hear G.D. Spradlin, his commanding officer, Walter E. Kurtz was a good man, but good does not always prevail over evil. And then what happens in the end? The evil in his own mind prevails. His last thought is not, tell my son that I was actually this man. He wants Willard to do that, and Willard presumably will do that. Mm. He'll go back and tell Kurtz's son what he really was. But the last thought is, I'm seeing that pile of little arms. I'm seeing the things I've seen over in Vietnam. In my dying moments, I am dying screaming, just like Kevin Smith's father.
You know, his commanding officer says he was a good man, but really he was a good soldier. He probably killed more people as a good soldier than he did as an evil man in Cambodia. Even though he kills people, it's just that he kills people without the rationalization that the army gave him to kill people before. And he's on trial for murder, even though the four people that he killed were almost definitely the double agents that were getting his men slaughtered.
Mm-hmm. That's what Willard says, the bullshit, and about how when enemy activity dropped off to next to nothing after he did that.
Yeah, exactly.
We discussed this on Patton, and we disagreed on this. I would take General Patton and Colonel Kurtz into war, as much as they don't follow orders, and put them in charge in the battlefield, and take my chances on us winning that war.
Would you rather fight with Kurtz or Kilgore?
Probably Kurtz.
Come on.
Kilgore doesn't see the forest for the trees. He's not a bad officer, I guess. He sure cared about his men. Kurtz is probably clinically insane, but if he hadn't stepped over the line just a little bit too much, stepped over the line somewhat, they probably wouldn't have objected to that. For some reason, they're not objecting to Kilgore, although maybe he's the next guy. Maybe the next Willard character many months or years down the road, not Willard necessarily, because he does say, I'm not even in their fucking army anymore, will be assigned to kill Kilgore. This whole thing where it goes on, this loop of these people that bend the rules and that don't follow orders. But I said it before to you, I've said it in other podcasts, and I'm saying it very clearly now, that if you want to go to war with anybody, the most savage thing you have to do to beat the other people, to beat the enemy, you do it. You slaughter them all. It's awful. What does Kurtz write in his book, Drop the Bomb, Exterminate them all, which suggests that he wants to exterminate not only his compound, but maybe all of Vietnam. Even though he seems to care about these people in his weird way, he's killed an awful lot of people in that village, of Cambodians and North Vietnamese.
No. He doesn't really show all that much affection towards them,
ever. He did, yeah. One of the deleted scenes that you didn't see is when Willard is in this heat hut kind of thing, and he reads some Time magazine articles, which are ironic, Nixon talking about how the war's going well, because that was in the late 60s, and the war publicly was still going okay. But then we see Brando in the light. We see him surrounded by kids. And some of the reviews that talked about how they liked that sequence, again, I think it ruins the character. When you only see Brando in the dark, little slivers of light here and there, and looking like this giant, Coppola cast another actor to play him in long shots to make him look like he's actually just massive in general, not just that he's got a 300-pound gut.
Yeah,
I think you ruin the illusion of that, too. But then you get into the whole element of the war isn't going well, and if it's not going well and you want to win it, then you need the Kurtzes and the Kilgores and the Pattons from 30 years before to go out there and run roughshod. If you don't want that to happen, then don't fight in the first place.
And all these generals, they're good at their job, but they're all a little mad. Patton included. Mm-hmm. All these people who are good at very efficiently exterminating other people, yeah, they're crazy.
I don't want to go to war personally or see my country or America or any other country go to war. But if you're going to commit to that, then go all the way or fucking forget it. Okay, it's a big cast. We won't dwell on them too much. We've mentioned them so much already. Martin Sheen, only a 5 film. What a great career. Still acting into this day, as we all know. His first big breakout was in Badlands, the Terry Malick film, and then he was in the West Wing as the president, as a political activist. He's been in so many movies and TV shows. We didn't say this yet. He had a heart attack on this film.
Yeah.
He nearly died.
On set.
He has the breakdown in the beginning of the film, which was actually real. Eleanor Coppola was worried that he was going to attack Francis because Francis was egging him on. And he was about to attack the camera at one point, they said.
And he was really shit-faced drunk, too.
He was actually drunk, and he was actually losing it. Apparently, his brother Joe was used as a stand-in a lot of scenes, but I've tried to look for it. I can't see where. Even in the voiceover, I don't know why, later on, many years after the fact. This movie took years to make, and they even used him in the voiceover. That's what it says online. I don't know if that's true or not. But I'm not really sure where, because Martin's face is generally what you see. Maybe there's some shots from behind where his brother was the stand-in, but he was out of action for a while. Harvey Keitel, we saw him in Taxi Driver, we're going to see him in Pulp Fiction. He had the role first. He actually shot for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And as is said in that Carl French book I mentioned a few minutes ago, why did Coppola ever think that an actor as twitchy and fidgety and active as Harvey Keitel could play such a passive character? Keitel could have played that drunken breakdown in the beginning very well, but the rest of the movie, I don't think he could have stayed still, and maybe that's what Coppola realized. So he had to recast and brings in Sheen, but he originally wanted Steve McQueen. He's a fucking asshole and overrated. Definitely could have played the stillness. Al Pacino, not surprisingly, was also in the running for it. And the Nick Nolte wanted the role. Probably would have been good, maybe a little too young for it at that point. I do think Sheen was the right choice for it. Wasn't nominated for the Oscar. Bit of a shame. Marlon Brando was top billed, as he was in Superman the year before this movie, but I think he shot it after they made this movie because this movie took so long to make. His final of 4 AFI films, if you can see Listen to Me, Marlon, if it comes out in theaters or on Netflix, we highly recommend it. Good documentary.
Excellent. Yeah, it probably will get wide release.
I do love, though, you got to cast the guy that is the one that everybody wants to see. Had it been Redford or Nicholson, there's that sequence in Hearts of Darkness where Coppola's on the phone talking to somebody back in Hollywood. Well, if Marlon doesn't show up, I'll cast those guys. Nicholson would have been better than Redford, but neither one of them had that mythic status. If they made the movie now, okay. But Brando was the older actor and the one that everyone wanted to see. Okay, Duvall. Another one. We've got so many people with their last AFI film. Brando, Hopper, Coppola, Duvall also, all making their last AFI film.
This movie just did them all in.
First movie for Duvall on the AFI list was To Kill a Mockingbird. He was in The MASH, the two Godfather films, and Network. He's barely in this one, though, despite his legendary performance. His screen time is about the same as what Beatrice Straight had in Network, maybe a little bit more. And even Brando in Apocalypse Now. Neither one of them are in this movie all that much, even though the billing is Brando, Duvall, and Sheen. Just like in Superman, it's Brando, Hackman, and Reeve. And Reeve is in the movie far more than anyone else, just like Sheen is in this film. I assume you like Duvall's performance.
Oh, yeah, I think he's incredible. And what a range, you know. In the AFI films that we have seen him in, he displays phenomenal range.
Dennis Hopper, final of four AFI films, Rebel Without a Cause, Giant, Easy Rider, not in the movie very much either. There's that sequence in Hearts of Darkness where he's arguing with Coppola, and he says, "You can't forget your lines until you know your lines."
So he was originally supposed to be a Marine type or a Green Beret or something. Then once he was on set and Coppola saw him just rambling
when he was
on,
being Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, when he's being Dennis Hopper, maybe you're a photojournalist now. And he just threw all these cameras around his neck and made it so.
He is the fool to Kurtz's Lear.
Yes.
Even though the only time he appears on any kind of set with Brando is the mutt when Brando throws bananas at him. They're not even on the screen at the same time, in fact. But Hopper's quoting him. It seems like he's been there for a while and they've been in this hut talking to him before. But maybe Kurtz is looking for that person that can carry on his legacy. And for some reason, Willard is the one. Colby wasn't. This photojournalist, not the one. But this guy, this Willard, this assassin, this grocery clerk, he's the one.
He's an errand boy.
Oh, right. He's an errand boy. Come to collect a bill. Exactly. Okay, Sam Bottoms as Lance. He was on The Last Picture Show and The Outlaw Josie Wells, one of my friend Frank and I favorite movie that we share. He was honored like a game rooster to have rid with Josie Wales. Albert Hall is in Malcolm X, but no other AFI films. His final seconds are not as poetic as most movie characters ever get, because when he gets the spear through his chest, what does he try to do as he falls over? He's trying to kill.
Incredible.
Most movies have him trying to say that last thing, "The diamond is behind the painting in the wall."
Yeah.
No, he's trying to murder somebody else.
They're allies for most of the film. It's just at the end you realize his true feelings, what they really are, and how incredibly strong they are, that he would use his last of his strength to murder this man. He hates him so much.
And then Willard actually is the one who kills him, literally. I mean, yes, the spear's what kills him, but Willard puts his hand over his mouth and that's what finishes him off. Larry Fishburne, later was in the Matrix trilogy, Boys in the Hood, not an AFI film, but maybe should have been. Chef gives him the nickname Bubba. And what other black character in an AFI film, ironically his name, Bubba, are we going to see? Forrest Gump.
Oh, of course.
And as Michael T. Williamson, that movie even says, "Do you believe that? It's like some redneck boy." In both cases, a redneck guy, or a southern guy at least, Chef, calling him Bubba. But Clean's performance is ironic in one key way. There's the irony of him using racial slurs like Slope and Charlie, something he would have suffered through in America, only it would have been the N-word. It would have been Slope, but that's their version of an N-word over there. Clean doesn't get the hypocrisy of that.
Well, I think that the social justice falls second to being able to rationalize murdering people.
And he is just a kid. He's also the one that starts that Eli massacre on the boat.
You need You need to make them the enemy, and that's part of it.
Harrison Ford's small performance as Lucas, which is definitely an homage to George Lucas. His third of five AFI films. You're still going to see him in Raiders and Blade Runner.
So if you wanted to make a great film in the late 70s, early 80s, it helped to cast Harrison Ford.
And except for working with Lucas twice, it was different directors every time. G.D. Spradlin is General Corman, the man in charge in that scene in Nha Trang. He was also in Godfather Part 2 as a senator. And the other guy in that sequence, the assistant director, Jerry Zeismer, has the other famous line from this movie, "Terminate with extreme prejudice."
Which is the only thing he says, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Never speaks other than that. And he's just a civilian. The other two guys are military officers. Okay, the auteur, the writer, director, producer, very small cameo as an actor, and he co-wrote the music with his father, Francis Ford Coppola's last AFI film. He's had five in the 70s, and he does have a good legacy because he is the patriarch of Sofia Coppola, and his nephew is Nicolas Cage.
Jason Schwartzman is related as well.
Talia Shire.
And didn't his Coppola's son, sister. Roman Coppola, what is he?
Yeah, his son Gio died in, the 80s, but Roman is making movies too.
Mm-hmm.
So they are a dynasty as big as any dynasty in the history of film. Bigger than the Houstons probably because of the number of people involved in the business. We talked about John Milius already, but one more thing I want to say about him is that he wanted to fight in Vietnam, but he had asthma so they wouldn't accept him. And he feels that directing is like being a war general. So this guy was maybe left out of his true calling, which was to shoot guns at people in war. The co-producers, well, there are many producers in total, but Gary Fredrickson, who was a co-producer on several Coppolas, including the two Godfather films. I mentioned before about tough productions that actually came out with a great movie. This one may be the most flawed of them all, but Jaws, Titanic, Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, Bridge of the River Kwai. A lot of those times they went off and shot in location or in water. This one, both on water and on a tough location. Unlike Jaws, at least that was in America.
Yeah, we haven't talked that much about what actually happened to the crew. There was a typhoon. Yeah. There was the heart attack. And another great reason to see the documentary Hearts of Darkness.
Yeah.
Because it catalogs the problems. A really incredible story.
All right, technically, and this movie is nothing if not for technical achievements, there's a varying widescreen aspect ratio. The Blu-ray that we watched, the 2:35:1 print, it looks pretty damn good. Probably even better than the Godfather films that Coppola did before that. And there are so many different cuts, but we watched the one that was released in theaters, which is about 2.5 hours long. Coppola's cinematographer, Vittorio Storaro's only AFI film, used the colored smoke everywhere. Lance's purple haze scene, when they're all reading their mail and Mr. Clean's listening to that tape from his mother back home, that is partly responsible for Clean's death, because maybe that's why the Viet Cong on the side of the river realized they're even there.
Even if they had already noticed the boat, smoke like that would have confirmed for them that it was a military boat.
Yeah, and Storaro used that smoke extremely well in this film. It is a beautiful looking picture. We talked about the editors already, but Walter Murch, one more tip of the hat. Outstanding work. His only actual AFI film as an editor, but he was involved in so many other pictures. He did cut Godfather Part 3 for Coppola and The English Patient and won some awards for that one. The music, Carmine Coppola, who was involved in both the Godfather films, and Francis, as I said, he was involved in, what's that, Five Jobs? Chaplin-esque? Ramis-esque?
Yes.
And we got to mention the sets. Dean Tavalaris, Angelo Graham, and George Nelson. Obviously, the movie is mostly set on location on a river. That incredible set in Cambodia they had to destroy at the end. And this is another controversial thing that played in different versions of the movie. They had to tear down the sets in the Philippines, and they exploded them. Then they shot that. And then Coppola put that at the end of one of the versions of this movie, and people thought that's the alternate ending. Willard called in the airstrike after all and blew them all up, but he didn't want that to be the idea. He wanted it to be that Sheen killed the one guy and then walked away. That's why he drops his weapon. Why would he drop his weapon and imply to all these people, I'm not going to be your god, and then murder them anyway, even though Kurtz's message on his manuscript is to exterminate them all. But that set was created by these guys, and there's that great moment again in the documentary Hearts of Darkness where you see people's heads sticking out, but they're not actual heads, they're people playing.
They're getting, like, sips of water from
and there's little umbrellas over their heads coming out of the sun. That brutal heat, all these people went through such hell making this movie. And kudos to those guys who made those sets that were washed away in that typhoon and had to rebuild them, too.
Yeah, if you look closely, there's just acres of details in each one of those sets. It's really beautiful.
One of the reasons I would like to watch this movie over and over again on that desert island I'm ever going to be on with a Blu-ray player and power. Okay, there's plenty of influence. A few in particular. We talked about Apocalypse before, Aguirre, Wrath of God. But Coppola even mentions Dr. Strangelove because of the absurdities of war. It was an influence on this picture, and that's one of our favorite movies. That was deliberately funny. This one is ironically funny sometimes. And Bridge on the River Kwai share some of the same themes. Chef even has that line. Thought you're going in there to blow up a bridge! Saving Private Ryan, I mentioned that before. You've got captains in both films. Sheen and Hanks are both the captains on their stupid missions.
I saw a lot of Full Metal Jacket in this film, too. I mean, you don't normally credit other directors with influencing Stanley Kubrick, but there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of similar themes.
He made his Vietnam film way after everyone else did, the year after Platoon, and many years after this, and Deer Hunter and Coming Home. So yeah, he must have been influenced in some way.
Seems like every film about Vietnam after Apocalypse Now was borrowing from Apocalypse Now.
I think so, yeah. Movies in general that came up for this film. We talked last week on The Deer Hunter about how Heaven's Gate, made by Michael Cimino, the one that followed The Deer Hunter, that helped end the director's era in the 70s. Mm. We're going to talk about the 70s in general in a few minutes here. This movie, too, as much as I loved it, it ended up being a success. It did not fail, but the press tried to tear it down before it even came out. And this movie did contribute to the end of the director's era because of egos. Coppola loved him, but he had a huge ego in this film, as did Brando, of course. The bloated budget. And this film contributed to that almost as much as the failure of Heaven's Gate did. Just because this succeeded, we gotta rein these fuckers back in. And let's make more Star Wars with these young kids and these fairly small budgets. Let's make more Jaws's with it was a big budget, but not that huge, with a 26-year-old kid. Okay, moving on. There's not a lot of awards in the AFI list, unfortunately. There should be, but there are not. It won 2 Oscars for cinematography and the great sound design. This movie is credited as the one that invented 5.1 surround sound.
Yeah, and it is a remarkable masterpiece. I don't think there's a better sound-edited film in cinema.
And Murch was involved in that. The 6 nominations that failed to win. I mentioned Kramer vs. Kramer won Best Picture. It's not a bad choice, but of course I would pick this one any day of the week. So it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director for Coppola, Best Supporting Actor for Duvall, the script by Milius and Coppola, the editing by Murch and friends, and the sets by Tavalaris and friends. Apocalypse Now took 11 years, but it made the National Film Registry in 2000, and the only other AFI recognition was, not surprisingly, number 12 on the top 100 quotes list, Say It, Bev.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
The three failed nominations, top 100 genres in the epic category, okay, maybe should have made that. Kurtz is a top 50 villain, that's debatable, he's actually a villain, but here's the one that really gets me. Top 100 songs, I hate that list, I've said that so many times in this project so far. The End, it wasn't an original song, but there are other songs on the list that weren't original songs. And if that could be nominated, at least for this list, whether it made it or not, why wasn't Ride of the Valkyries nominated?
Oh my God, you're so right. That's a great point.
Wagner's great music that predated this movie by hundreds of years, I guess it would have been. Whenever people hear that music, or The End, maybe not quite as much The End actually, they think of this movie.
Absolutely.
So the AFI list sometimes get it right, but the songs and the quotes fucking get it wrong so often. Okay, we've had a long podcast, but let's do something for a couple minutes at least here, because we are at the end of a decade and a long one. The decade we're about to do is going to be extremely short. We've only got, I think it's 9 movies in all the 80s, and one of those years, 1982, has 4. But the 70s had all these films, some of the greats of all time, The Godfather and The Godfather Part II, Chinatown, all of 1975 with Cuckoo's Nest, Jaws, and Nashville, Taxi Driver, Annie Hall, Star Wars, and now Apocalypse Now.
The 70s, I mean, what can you say? It truly is this little pocket of creativity and innovation and guts, you know. They really tried new things and they really took chances, and it's a shame it had to come to an end. It didn't have to come to an end, it just did, because studios are a business, and unfortunately, you know, there were circumstances that forced them to stop taking as many risks as they were taking. What can you say? The 70s is one of the greatest decades in movie history. They say the golden age was the late 30s, but for my money, I would pick the 70s.
Well, obviously, this is way better.
Yeah, I think it was when America finally caught up with what the rest of the world was doing, but they had the Hollywood budgets to go with it, and they created some of the greatest masterpieces. Like this film, my favorite is Chinatown. Love Godfather so much, and Network is such a great, fun movie. Taxi Driver, watching that again, reminding me what an incredible film that is. Annie Hall, I love that one too. Star Wars, you know, it's not my favorite, but I mean, who can deny the power and the influence and just the joy that film has brought people?
Maybe every decade could say this, but this one in particular seems to stand out as one that has so many types of films too. The Godfather is about period crime, because it's from the 40s but made in the 70s. Chinatown's the same.
Yeah,
set even earlier than that, and also crime and politics. Taxi Driver and Annie Hall are contemporary in New York. One's about horrible people, one's about regular people. Star Wars is a complete fantasy. This movie's about something that happened about 10 years before. Crazy War, Deer Hunter was the same. Jaws is contemporary, but also kind of sci-fi in a way, with this enormous shark. Cuckoo's Nest was real, very real. Nashville was very real. But we really covered the gamut of all kinds of films. I think it's the best decade by a mile. I love the 90s too, maybe because I was around 20 in the middle of the
90s. Yeah, we were like in that perfect age for the 90s for all those great independent and gutsy films.
And there are more movies on this top of our list than the 80s. Even though they would have had less chance to make it, because the movies in 96, when they stopped voting for the 98 list, they barely had half the decade to vote on.
Yeah.
And then in 2007, they think it was 2005 was the last bit of nominees. So now the movies that were made up to 1999 weren't very old. They didn't have a chance to really gain that kind of cachet. And we said, as long as we picked, like Groundhog Day, that if they were to re-vote on this, would probably make it. But in 2007, it really hadn't had that kind of cachet built up. Shawshank Redemption made it, which I was glad to see.
Yeah.
But it had no chance to make it the first time
around.
So to me, those two decades are easily the best ones, but we're both biased because we did grow up on those two. They're definitely in the running, though. 70s, 90s, and okay, the 30s, I guess, too.
Yeah, the 70s has an advantage for you and I, because I think the 70s set the blueprint for all these films after that, and it speaks the same language as the movies that we would have grown up watching, like the current movies that we were used to, because we're still fairly young. We don't speak the same film language that people spoke in the 30s, and films have grown up so much since then. To go back and watch them is to put yourself in that time and place, but we don't have to do that for the 70s. It already speaks the same language that we understand.
And some of these movies are not dated at all. The 80s is what we're seeing being remade so often in movies to this day. RoboCop and Terminator's being made all over again.
Mad Max.
In theaters right now. Those people were influenced by the 70s more so than the 80s. But let's end this one. It's been a hell of a long podcast. Go.
I almost wish this film wasn't so effective on me, because I would be more inclined then to watch it more often and really drink it in. It paints this strikingly beautiful picture of the most horrifying aspect of human nature and doesn't let you look away. It is a rare work of art in the truest sense. I think it belongs higher than 30 on the list, I'll say that.
Oh, definitely.
Sure.
And it dropped 2 spots.
I don't like that.
Pretty crazy. We said the deer hunter raised, and we think one of the reasons why was the Iraqi war, and then maybe people felt differently about PTSD and war vets. Well, these guys are kind of going through the same thing, and somehow that movie lost a little steam, and Deer Hunter gained a lot of steam.
It has pretty different themes, though. It really takes you to a deeper, darker place. They don't share a lot. Yeah.
Well, if you watch one of the links I included to you in last week's podcast, when Cimino wins the directing Oscar for The Deer Hunter, Coppola was one of the presenters, and he says, "My pie's on!" So Italians sharing the Oscar. Coppola probably thought he maybe was going to win the next year. And I like Kramer versus Kramer, but I think he should have. So that was Apocalypse Now, podcast number 100. We're done. Thank you. Top 100 project finished.
Yep. Round up. Thanks for listening.
Oh, wait. We have 23 more to go. All right. Well, the 80s begins next week as we cover the second gripping Scorsese-De Niro collaboration, Raging Bull. The coming attractions trivia for Raging Bull. The popular movie destination of New York is where Raging Bull takes place. What's the final AFI movie to be primarily set in New York?
All right. So for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast for Raging Bull. If you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and you can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to speak to Ryan and I directly, you can just send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Toronto. Shit. I'm still only in Toronto.
And cut.